we did lose a lot of ground on the west side of our community, right where the first rock revetment was placed.
Communities in Western Alaska assess the damage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the politics of climate change.
It's not rocket science. I mean, it's science, but it's not that hard to verify.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. November is National Family Caregivers and Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Are you one of the thousands of Alaskans who provide care for a family member who is chronically ill, elderly, or has a disability? Where there are resources and help for you and your loved one. For information, visit alaskaaging.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Aging and the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority.
State troopers and search and rescue personnel are looking for a man missing in Teller. Trooper Ann Sears says 26-year-old Kyle Komak was last seen on a yellow four-wheeler about 4 p.m. yesterday.
Folks had seen him drive out to the point in Teller, and waves were crashing over the point at that time, and that, you know, he had driven out on his four-wheeler, and he was seen almost tipping over at that point.
Teller Search and Rescue went through town to see if he was staying with anyone. They also searched the lake behind Teller. No tracks were found in that area. Water, rocks, logs, and ice moved in on Nome last night. The surge peaked just shy of 10 feet around 5 o'clock. Rocks sprayed onto Front Street and water washed out a portion of the highway around 15 miles east of town. Cleanup operations were begun and in some cases finished early today. Incident Commander Chip Leeper says the Nome road crew took care of the debris quickly.
They're amazing. They had everything pretty much cleared off before probably the average Nomite got out of bed, so I don't think the average person got to really see the full amount of debris that was tossed up, because between them and the state had their graders out there about 6:30. So honestly, as far as from a roads perspective, by the time daybreak came, all the roads had been cleared.
Leeper says he saw less debris this time around than he did in the 2004 storm. After Nome realigned its harbor, the dredged sand has moved in front of a portion of downtown. Leeper says this mini beach may have helped to push out the crashing waves.
And because of that, the waves are breaking on that beach as opposed to the seawall. So that's just an extra added benefit. We might get a beach to play on and we'll get an extra layer of protection from the ocean.
Echoing a common sentiment today, Leeper says it was not as bad as some scenarios predicted.
It could have been worse. I think the damage could have been much higher and much worse, and I think we could have had more damage, but I think that you know, it helped that we didn't really have some of the direct southerly winds, and it was shifting around, because that could have caused more problems. But the tide height was actually a foot taller than our predicted model, and it still wasn't as bad as we thought. So again, that just goes back to planning for the worst, and if you don't have the worst, it's good.
The city is now compiling expenses for reimbursement in case the situation is declared a disaster by the state. Two sentiments being expressed from coastal communities after the storm and ocean surges have subsided are relief and the importance of being prepared and organized. Shishmaref Mayor Howard Wayawana says all storm and flood warnings were canceled this morning for the area. He says high surfs started building yesterday afternoon and lasted until 4 this morning, resulting in significant erosion.
Mostly during the evening, we did lose a lot of ground on the west side of our community, right where the first rock revetment was placed. We lost like 20 to 30 feet of erosion ground.
Wayawana says the ocean ate into the corner of the rock revetment and is now less than 100 feet from three homes. In Kivalina, City Council member Colleen Swan says things have settled down and are quiet now, but last evening the ocean crashed through the south end channel into the lagoon. She says people began moving elders and children to the school. She says children in the community are stressed by the event, and after the evacuation of 2007, she says her 12-year-old son gets scared by storms.
That never leaves his mind. Every time we get a storm, he asks me, are we going to be evacuated? And you hear that when you run into children on the streets or, you know, the children at the school, it had a very lasting impression on them, and it's a very stressful time for them.
North of Unalakleet, the village of Shaktulik appears to have weathered the storm well. Shaktulik Mayor Eugene Asiksik heads the emergency command center there. He says in the village, things are returning to normal.
It's hard to tell right now if we had any erosion. I kind of doubt it. Most of our erosion occur from side swiping, and this storm was more a direct hit from the ocean. Once the wind switched from east to south and southwest.
Another storm is brewing for southwest Alaska. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning-Barnes has more.
The new storm is bringing a blizzard warning to the region Friday.
There's so much snow in it, and even Bethel will get some winds. It's pretty much for everybody.
Pete Garrison is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Bethel. Everybody means all of the YK Delta and most of Bristol Bay, too. Southeast winds are expected to reach 50 miles an hour in some areas, with 4 to 8 inches of snow. The snow is expected to change to rain, particularly further south. Garrison says this storm has been expected as part of a line of systems from the Bering Sea.
Even before the huge one, the track of them is they're just moving in pretty rapidly, one low after the other. This is actually about number 4.
The southwest storm shouldn't last long, though, and should be over by Friday night. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Like it or not, discussions about climate change in the United States are awash in politics. The vast majority of scientists agree the planet is warming as a result of man-made greenhouse gas emissions, which itself raises serious social and political questions. But skeptics say the problem is blown out of proportion. Starting tonight, the Juneau World Affairs Council hosts a 3-day conference focusing on the politics of climate change. KTOO's Casey Kelly has this preview.
Political scientist and economist Detlef Sprinz is a senior scientist at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Sprinz will give the keynote address at the Juneau World Affairs Council's conference titled The Politics of Global Climate Change. His Friday evening talk poses the question, is long-term climate policy politically feasible?
Yes, but it's difficult. In the most clear sense, it needs parliamentary and here legislative majorities, but also it needs credibility with the mass public, but it also needs entrepreneurship, finding more interesting and cheaper technologies to move us closer to a low greenhouse gas or low carbon future.
Ultimately, Sprint says any successful policy begins with a period of uncertainty.
We have to move away from essentially short-term profits to long-term profits. And we also have, like for any new problems, be very experimental. But frankly, we do this all the time.
Much of the uncertainty about current climate change policy has to do with doubts about the science behind it.
No climatologist disagrees that there are two causes for the climate change. One is natural change, and the other is man-made change.
Sun-Ichi Akasofu is founding director of the International Arctic Research Center and professor of physics at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's part of a panel that will review the current state of climate change science as well as the contrarian view. Akasofu says he may be a contrarian, but don't call him a skeptic.
I don't like the term skeptics, okay, or deniers. According to my study, 5/6 of the present warming is due to natural changes. Only 1/6 is due to man-made. And if you want to correct that, you're wasting your time, money, because natural changes, you cannot stop it.
As director of the Arctic Research Center, Akasofu oversaw a study that showed natural changes in ocean currents are causing some of the warming in the Arctic Ocean.
Warm water from North Atlantic is very, very crucial in understanding the changes of the ice conditions.
Biologist Brendan Kelly will appear with Akasofu, but bring a different point of view. Currently deputy director of the Arctic Research Division at the National Science Foundation, Kelly has studied sea ice ecosystems in the Arctic for 35 years. He's convinced man-made greenhouse gas emissions are responsible for the rapidly accelerating rate of climate change in the last two decades.
The evidence is pretty compelling. Greenhouse gases are there. We know the physics of it. We know how it works to re-radiate heat back into the atmosphere that otherwise would have escaped. Yeah, it's not rocket science. I mean, it's science, but it's not that hard to verify.
He also notes that a significant chunk of the world's human population lives at or near sea level.
All you have to do in Alaska is look at communities like Shishmaref that are being severely threatened by increased coastal erosion. This is not only a function of sea level rise, but also a function of sea ice loss and increased storminess on the coast.
Kelly says scientists can argue over the cause of climate change, but that won't stop it from happening, and it doesn't mean that mankind shouldn't try to mitigate the effects of it.
We don't really have the luxury of spending a lot of time debating whose fault it is or isn't. We need to get sober about the fact that this is, as I say, is a rate of change that is very hard for ecosystems and biological systems to respond to, and ultimately, I think, can be very hard for society to respond to.
The Juneau World Affairs Council's Climate Change Conference starts tonight at the University of Alaska Southeast. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a push for strengthening tribal authority.
We're not going to allow our young people to be separated from us anymore. We're not going to allow our young people to be separated from our traditional government or our traditional ways.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. Alaska Business Monthly, providing a source for statewide in-depth business news on Twitter at AK Business Month or Facebook. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Authorities have charged a former Ketchikan City Councilman with 81 additional counts of possessing child pornography. Ketchikan police say two of the additional charges were filed after a homemade video was found showing John Jack W. Shea with a young girl. The Ketchikan Police Department says in a release that the other charges stem from images found on Shea's computer. Shea was arrested last Friday night and charged with 10 counts after he took his computer and printer to a repair shop. There was an announcement over the weekend of what looks like the biggest natural gas discovery in Cook Inlet in 25 years. Escapeda Oil claimed early success in the first well drilled by its jackup offshore drilling rig, and the well is not complete yet. APRN's Steve Heimel has more.
It's a big deal if large sources of natural gas are found in Cook Inlet because gas is the prime heating and power generation fuel in the region. And production has dropped off so much that first the Nikiski fertilizer plant that used gas and then the LNG export plant have had to shut down. But the Escapeda announcement is just one of a number of developments that could bring new gas into the system, one of which already is. The company was expecting to find 1 or 2 trillion cubic feet of gas, but by the time they had drilled to 8,805 feet, they had found an estimated 3.5. And the company hasn't even yet reached deeper layers that would qualify it for state tax credits that would cover most of the cost of its drilling effort. Anchorage Representative Mike Hawker, who wrote some of the incentive legislation, is ready to claim victory.
You know, I dubbed a bill that I sponsored and passed 2 years ago, the Cook Inlet Recovery Act, and I've got to tell you, the Cook Inlet does seem to have recovered. I'm just incredibly pleased with the results we're seeing out there.
Those more familiar with the inlet's geology are more cautious than Escapeda about this prospect known as Kitchen Lights. The estimate is for gas in place, not what is recoverable, and at current prices, gas still doesn't have anywhere near the pay that crude oil does. But State Oil and Gas Division Director Bill Barron says Escapeda's announcement is one of a number of developments that indicate more active exploration of the inlet.
The inlet's kind of gotten a little bit more active than it has over the past probably 5 to 7 years. So typically activity is a good thing, which means people are kind of looking, and if you don't look, you can't find.
The geology of the inlet is getting better known with new wells, but also because the new 3D seismic technology is coming into play. Apache is one of the companies doing that exploration, and whatever it sees has made it an active bidder on inlet leases. Meanwhile, Buccaneer is bringing a second jackup rig to the inlet and has already developed gas wells onshore near Kenai, and those have sent tens of millions more cubic feet per day into the system. Cook Inlet has a complex geology, and its deeper layers have only been drilled into a couple of times. And there's been much speculation about what might be found in the Jurassic level.
The target in the Jurassic is going to be interesting in terms of a broader oil play, not necessarily a gas play. That doesn't mean that you can't discover gas in deep horizons. So it will be interesting to see what people encounter on the way down of any well. It's similar to Apache. They have come out publicly stating that their goals are deeper oil targets, but they aren't going to be surprised if they encounter shallow gas along the way. So that's the nature of the Cook Inlet Basin.
Next summer, when Buccaneer gets its jackup rig in place and Escapeda gets back to its kitchen lights well, the answers will begin coming in about what's down in the Jurassic. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Escapeda's natural gas discovery in Cook Inlet offers another option for getting a cleaner, more affordable energy source to Fairbanks. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, it offers a potential alternative to an in-state gas pipeline from the North Slope.
The big Cook Inlet gas find was part of the discussion at a meeting of the State House and Senate Joint Committee on In-State Gas in Fairbanks Wednesday. Fairbanks State Senator Joe Pascvan says the discovery presents a new gas pipeline option for Fairbanks.
For the immediate interior Alaska needs, it may be an idea to build a 20-inch line from Big Lake north to interior Alaska.
Pascvan says even at current low-side estimates, the Escapeda find is a potential game changer for in-state energy.
You know, at 3.5 trillion cubic feet, there is enough for distribution internally in Alaska for decades.
The gas could be developed within a couple of years, but pipeline construction would take several more. Fairbanks Senator Joe Thomas says that's good long term, but Fairbanks residents struggling with high energy prices and poor air quality need more immediate help.
Fairbanks still needs to look out for itself as far as a project like the gas trucking. And of course, you have to have distribution. So both of those issues have risen to the top here now as to what we do.
Sponsors of two projects in the works to truck LNG from the North Slope to Fairbanks were at the Gas Caucus meeting. Golden Valley Electric Co-op and Flint Hills Refinery are partnering to bring gas to town for their own use, a plan GVEA says will reduce consumer power bills 2.5%. Golden Valley CEO Brian Newton says the utility is also in talks with companies interested in distributing gas for local heating use.
We've got quite a few interested parties. We're working with them right now to sign confidentiality agreements, and we'll be working with them to narrow their demands and blend it with ours.
The most obvious entity to take on that aspect of the project is Fairbanks Natural Gas, a company which already has a fleet of tanker trucks, a local storage facility, and limited local distribution network. FNG originally took up the gas trucking idea, but CEO Dan Britton says they've only had preliminary discussions with GVEA and Flint Hills about their project. Britton says FNG is focused on going it alone.
Our plan is to produce a product that's for the entire interior, including Golden Valley, Flint Hills, and the heating market.
Britton says Fairbanks Natural Gas is at least a year ahead of Golden Valley and Flint Hills on a gas trucking project, including permitting, engineering, site location, and supply contract issues. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you receive Medicare, the time to join, switch, or drop Medicare prescription drug plans is earlier this year. It's between October 15th and December the 7th. Every year, plans change and your needs change. To find the Medicare prescription drug plan that's best for you, call Alaska's Medicare Information Office at 1-800-478-6065. That's 1-800-478-6065. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Alaska tribal members were in Portland last week for National Congress of American Indians, or NCAI, conference meetings, where resolutions supporting a variety of initiatives were passed. Edward Alexander is the second chief of the Gwichaja Gwichin tribal government in Fort Yukon. Alexander points to growing concerns about future control of traditional land and the disenfranchising of Alaska Natives born after 1971 who were left out of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Alexander says one of the resolutions addresses concerns about traditional lands that are now within Alaska Native corporations. He says Alaska's indigenous people need to build consensus for taking control of the future.
We've allowed a foreign government, the United States, to say that our children are separated from their land and resources. They're not shareholders in our corporations. You know, at some point, we have to say, well, hey, we're not going to allow our young people to be separated from us anymore. We're not going to allow our young people to be separated from our traditional government or our traditional ways. And I think that that time is now. And I think that our young people need to know that they have leaders that are speaking up for them.
The resolution would form an Alaska Native Restoration Commission based on the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin's successful efforts in regaining their rights as a tribe after their tribal status was terminated by Congress and their successful logging operation was turned into a corporation that began to have financial trouble. The Menominee fought and prevailed in getting their reservation lands or Indian country status restored and brought their timber business back under tribal control. Alexander says he sees parallels in Alaska to the Menominee.
Basically, what the Restoration Commission is tasked with doing is to obtain a legal analysis of the Menominee Restoration Act and its potential applicability to Alaska, and also to look at other legal alternatives to basically restoring some of the rights that tribes have been effectively denied thus far.
He says commission members must ask Native people if they think the social experiment of ANCSA has been good or bad. The Fort Yukon Gwich'in transferred their land from their village corporation to the tribe and negotiated an agreement that allows the corporation to retain economic development rights. The tribe controls the land, and if there are disputes, they are arbitrated by the tribal government. Alexander says he worries ANCs, like other corporations, could go out of business in the future, and traditional land could be lost to bankruptcy or taxes.
The Gwich'in people are forever. The Yupik people are forever. The Nupak people are forever. And those people, those Yupik people, those Tlingit people, they have the right to retain their land. And not in a corporate structure, but in a structure that they have a chance to define. And that's sovereignty. That's self-determination. And to suggest that we don't have such power, is to suggest tyranny.
But in a recent lecture in Juneau, Sea Alaska director and former CEO Byron Malott says the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act is a work in progress. Malott kicked off Sea Alaska Heritage Institute's annual Native American History Month lecture series last week by calling the landmark piece of federal legislation unfinished business.
It's unfinished in the sense that it has been amended many, many times in order to be responsive to changing public policy, the changing aspirations of Native peoples themselves. But it has also big chunks of it that need to be rationalized and dealt with.
Sea Alaska is one of 12 regional Native corporations created by ANCSA in 1971. Each received land to settle the various Aboriginal claims of Alaska Native people. The settlement also included compensation of nearly $1 billion that was split between the companies. A 13th corporation was later formed for Alaska Natives who live out of the state. Malott hopes ANCSA will be amended in the future to allow land swaps between Native corporations, tribes, and the federal government. A new study on Cook Inlet vessel traffic is giving planners a clear idea of what the waterway's future will look like. The research is part of a larger risk assessment study, which could lead to new laws or improvements at Cook Inlet ports. Tara Bicknell has more on the study, which is currently out for public comment.
Tim Robertson with Planning Group Nuka Research says there are fewer tankers and bulk carriers moving through Cook Inlet now following the closure of a Nikiskie plant and drop in wood products leaving the inlet. But he calls overall vessel traffic consistent over the last decade.
The major things that we found is that there are about 500 deep draft vessels that come and go out of Cook Inlet every year, and about 200 barge transits within Cook Inlet every year.
The vessel traffic study, released to the public for comment this month, shows today's traffic to be a slight increase over 2006. It also showed the highest amount of the area's vessel activity to be in Ketchumak Bay, primarily due to ships awaiting a marine pilot or Coast Guard inspection.
One of the things that's fairly unique about Cook Inlet compared to other ports is that about 80% of our deep draft traffic is based on 15 vessels that come and go, and those vessels are vessels like tote and Sealand ships that come and go to Anchorage, the Alaska Marine Highway ferries that come and go to southern Cook Inlet, and then the tankers that come and go to the Tesoro plant.
The recently released study analyzing marine traffic is an initial task for a much larger project, developing a risk assessment plan for Cook Inlet, which could result in new legislation or physical changes to the waterway. Jerry Rombach is with Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council, one of 13 groups represented in the team tasked with making recommendations for risk mitigation in the inlet. He says the 52-page traffic study that was presented to the team late last month includes a forecast of vessel traffic over the next decade. It projects a flat or moderate increase and changes in cargo, vessels, and fuel types.
Those are all critical to give us an idea of 2010 and projected to 2019, what kind of traffic and cargo we're likely to see.
The study is available online for review and comment at cookinletriskassessment.com. The comment period closes November 30th. I'm Tara Bicknell.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Tara Bicknell in Haines. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.